Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon to everyone. On today's IRTPB call on Tuesday the 23rd of March, we have Michele Nalon, Barbara Steele, James Bladel, Paul Diaz, Mikey O'Connor, Matt Thurlan, Ferry Cobb, Kevin Erdman, Chris Chaplow. As guest, we have Scott Hollenbeck. From staff, we've got Glenda Saint-Géry, Marika Konings, David Geezer, and myself, Gisela Kruger-White. We don't have any apologies. And if we can please remind everyone to state their names when speaking. Thank you. Over to you, Michele.
Thank you, Gisela. Okay, we've done the roll call, so I'd like to welcome Scott from VeriSign, who's going to be talking to us about the wonderful world of EPP. And for those of you, you should all have got an email yesterday from Marika, which goes over one of the RFCs regarding the statuses that are shown in EPP. And I assume you all read that. Scott, over to you.
I'm not exactly sure what you want me to say. Barbara had said I would be available to ask answer two questions.
Oh, okay, fair enough. I think part of the problem we were having, and somebody else can take me up on this, is that there's a bit of confusion about EPP statuses and how that entire thing works. There was a reasoning behind this. Mikey or James might be able to say a bit more on this. Mikey?
Thanks, Michele. This is Mikey, and it's great to have you on the call today, sir. I think that we had two things. One, we needed to get a little bit better understanding of the mechanics of EPP, but the main thing that I think we were working on was the possibility of changing the statuses to be more human understandable, and perhaps refining them a bit so that registrants and registrars, for that matter, would have a better idea of which status meant which thing. And we didn't want to get too far into a big discussion about that without a little bit of knowledge of sort of where the easy parts of EPP status could, which parts of that could be changed easily and which part would be very disruptive from an implementation standpoint. And I think that's really part of the reason that we needed to have you on the call. James, you want to flesh that out a bit?
No, Mikey, I think that's a pretty good synopsis. There were several discussions about locking versus transfers and what a registrant or another registrar would see in the whois to determine whether or not a domain name was in a certain locked state and whether certain statuses could be distinguished just by looking at the whois, registry locks versus registrar locks. So really what I think we were looking for was just some clarification on all of the different statuses that are available and who controls them, who can, and which party can release them.
Okay. I have to apologize, but I don't have the actual spec in front of me. I'm sitting at a gate at Dulles Airport waiting to catch a plane. So those of you who have the document in front of you, if I miss one, please remind me, and I'll be glad to go into more detail to describe what it is and how it works. The ones related to locking, though, there are eight, four of which are managed by clients, which you can translate to mean registrars, and four of which are managed by the server, which you can translate to mean a registry. There's one locking status, two, one for the registrar, one for the registry, for each of the four transform commands, or the commands that can manipulate the state of an object. In this case, we're talking about a domain name. There are transfer prohibited status values, update prohibited status values, renew prohibited status values, and delete prohibited status values. Depending on which of the two parties sets one, if the domain is in any one of those states, the transform operation identified by the command in the status value will be prohibited.
So, for example, if a registrar wants to offer a service that can be used to prevent transfers, they can set the transfer prohibited. I'm sorry, the client transfer prohibited status value, and requests to transfer the domain will be rejected. Similarly, the registry operator can set any one of the four status values to prevent one of the transform operations from happening. And they can do that as part of a value-added service, or they can do it for non-payment, or for whatever reason their policy deems to be appropriate. If there are other status values that describe the current state of a domain, such as OK. The OK status is meant to mean that there is nothing, there are no lock values and no other status values set. What other values are listed in among the list?
I'm just bringing up the document now, Scott.
Thank you.
If I can find it.
Is this the one that's in the Adobe Connect, Marika?
This is the RFC that's up here, the RFC 5731.
It's one of the subsections, though, specifically.
Section
2.3, is it?
2.3, correct,
2.3.
Okay. Okay, here, I'm going to send you a link on the chat, guys, just to that specific section, just onto the IETF website. Okay, the status values are... Hold on a second. The IETF website works over IPv6. There, useless factoid of the afternoon. Client delete prohibited, server delete prohibited, client hold, server hold, client renew prohibited, server renew prohibited, client transfer prohibited, server transfer prohibited, client update prohibited, server update prohibited, inactive, OK, pending create, pending delete, pending renew, pending transfer, pending update.
Okay. Right. Let's talk about the pending values. Those all exist because there are some registry business policies that will allow a client to request one of those operations, like a renew. But for whatever reason, the renew does not take effect when the command is completed on the server. So the protocol includes a status value to let you know that a command has been received and processed successfully, but the actual action has not yet been fully implemented. Those are the pending values. Inactive. It basically means the domain exists in the database but does not exist in the zone. This can sometimes happen where a domain is registered initially. But again, for example, the registry might have to take some out-of-band authentication steps to determine if a registrant or a registrar is authorized to register the name. And for whatever reason, it's reserved, as in it cannot be registered by someone else, but it has not yet been published in the zone.
Okay, Scott, I've just got a couple of people who want to ask you questions, I think. Since she's a lady, we'll let Marika go first, and then we'll have James.
This is Marika. This is basically to add on to what James and Mikey already said. Because one of the reasons I think we wanted to talk as well is that someone, as part of the public comment period, had suggested that each status value can have a message accompanying it, and that person was suggesting that a way of clarifying some of the statuses in relation to lock status might be to have that message accompany that would explain to a registrant what it actually means and what they could do to actually unlock a domain. And I think we were trying to understand as well how that would work in practice and whether that would require a change in the protocol or, how that would work.
Well, it wouldn't require a change in the protocol because, as you noted, the feature already exists. It would be up to the registry operator or the registrar, the entity that sets the status, to provide the text to be included there. So how it would work? Well, a policy action could dictate that
if a domain name is in a particular status, that a particular text string appears along with it. That's one way.
Thank you.
Sure.
James?
Hi, this is James speaking. Thanks, Michele, and thanks for the overview, Scott. I have just a couple of comments or questions on this lock status. The first one being that there's another lock status that can occur external to EPP, and that can be a registrar service where the domain is locked versus transfers or updates within the registrar account, and that may or may not coincide with the lock status that's maintained at the registry via EPP, the client transfer prohibited, and other locks like that. The reason being that some registrars view that as a separate layer of security against inadvertent transfer, deletion, or update of the registration. I'm certain, although I'm not personally familiar with any, I'm certain that there are registrars out there as well that tie their own lock products to the registry's EPP status, so that if a client manipulates the lock status in their registrar account, that is immediately passed on upstream to the registry, whereas some registrars would probably view that as two separate locks. Is that your experience as well, Scott, or care not to speculate on?
Well, no. It's not my experience, and as a registrant, I mean, the registrars that I've done business with all seem to implement lock in such a way that when I change something in my customer account, it gets reflected at the registry. Now, having said that, the registrars can basically do whatever they want in that sense. If they want to add another layer of security, that's one way they can differentiate themselves from the competition. The challenge, though, of course, is if a domain is in such a state that they have to find a way to present that information to a to people, people being either registrants or people who look at it in registrar who is. That would be an interesting thing to deal with when you have a thick registry where the registry maintains all of the state information. I don't quite know how they would do that. EPP does not have a provision for status values beyond those that are currently specified unless you get into the extension mechanism, which is part of the protocol. But that would have to be something negotiated between the registry and the registrar.
Okay, thanks.
Well, Mikey?
Thanks, Michele. Scott, mine is more of a kind of operational question, and that is, going back to that text string that's displayed along with the status, if we were to wave a magic wand and say that would be a really good idea, who would have to do what in order to get that text string to display and who is?
Both registries and registrars would have to make changes in their implementation to display a particular text string.
Okay. Thanks. That's exactly sure. What I was afraid of.
Well, yeah, those are the publishers of who is. So if you want to put something there, they have to change it.
Yeah, all right. Thanks.
Welcome. Were there any other specific questions, or can I talk for a few moments on the larger question at the beginning about how easy it is to change the protocol?
I think you should just go ahead there, unless somebody else has a specific question. Guys, anybody? No, go ahead, Josh.
Okay. In short, very difficult. EPP is now a full standard from the IETF's perspective, which means we've got, well, it doesn't mean we've got 10 years of operational experience, but that is what we've got. It's been reviewed essentially three different times and published as proposed standard, then draft standard, then full standard, with each promotion opportunity being there to make either minor changes, minor corrections, and to date no one has indicated a need to do so. Changing the protocol to make the status values more human intuitive is probably not a good idea because the protocol is intended to be interpreted by machines, and we would need another, I would like to suggest that another layer of software would probably be a more appropriate place to do that, such as like Whois. If you look at the Whois protocol, it basically doesn't say that there's any syntax to the commands beyond send me a string that's terminated with a line feed or a carriage return. And so it's relatively easy to translate like a server transfer prohibited to a text string that says something like, you know, hey, you cannot transfer this domain, please contact the registry or something like that. On top of the difficulty in changing the protocol, the one thing that is in the protocol that we built in to try to make this a little bit easier is something I described a moment ago called the expansion mechanism. It's very easy to add additional features to EPP by coming up with a new specification that could, for example, have additional or finely grained status values. That would require some negotiation between registry and registrar, since both would have to implement it, but the protocol has hooks in the appropriate places to make that relatively easy to do. Any questions about that? Sure.
Dr. McKaylee here. Just with regards to the extensions, a lot of the GTLDs already use extensions in their own implementation of EPP, from what I understand. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
So I think from what I recall, there is a command you can run on EPP which will pull back the endpoints implementation, like you'll get back a catalog of the extensions that a particular registry is running. Am I confusing things?
No. When the client attempts to connect to a server, the server is obligated to publish a list of all of the mappings that it implements, and you can translate mapping here to extension. So that's absolutely correct.
Okay. So that's why I was right. Okay.
Right, and then when the client attempts to log into the server to create a session, they are obligated to identify all of the mappings that they wish to use during the course of that session. So there's a little bit of a negotiation up front, where there's an advertisement and then a confirmation of the services to be provided.
Okay. So let's say, for example, in the case of VeriSign. How long would it take, for example, for VeriSign to make a change how long would it take them to implement a change, say, adding a more descriptive text field for an existing status, for example?
That's a two-pronged question. There is a technical answer, as in how long would it take us to manipulate the software to do that, and there's a policy answer that involves negotiation with registrars. Barbara, I'll let you talk to how the negotiation with registrars things work and how we have to set things up in OTE and whatnot. But the short technical answer would be that it would probably take something on the order of a couple of months. It would very likely have to be built into a planned release that we've already got on our engineering roadmap. It would then have to be tested. It would have to be deployed. And typically, releases can take on the order of somewhere between 2 to 4 months.
Okay. Does anybody else have any questions on this? Mikey?
I want to follow up on your last point, Scott. Suppose that you did roll out such a change and we added a text enhancement, basically, to a status. How disruptive would that be to a registrar that chose not to implement something on their end? Would it just pass by and not be acknowledged, or would it break their systems as the release went out?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's no clear answer to that, because it could do both. A registrar is technically obligated to have implemented the protocol in the way that it's currently specified. So if VeriSign were to simply change a text string or to add a text string, but without changing the protocol, the registrar's software systems should not break. My own experience is that it would be naive to think that that's how it would actually work. The registrars tend to implement the specification selectively. You know, that is, they implement certain features that are relevant to whatever it is they want to do, and that VeriSign has to be very careful about any changes we make to our server-side implementation. We change, you know, very minor things, and registrars' systems break. This is why we have an operational test and evaluation environment where we set up server software and let it vape for quite some time before we set it loose in the live environment.
Does that answer your question, Mikey?
Yeah, I think so. Thanks very much.
Sure. Barbara?
Hi, this is Barbara. I just actually had a couple of questions. As Scott said, we actually do, put everything out there in an OT&E environment so the registrars can go out and test their systems to make certain that nothing does break. If we are making a change that is going to impact registrars, we also provide a 90-day notice that that's coming up and give them a summary of what is changing so that they're prepared for it. The other question I had actually is for Scott, and whether or not if we were to negotiate with registrars individually or collectively as to how to use the extensions, do all of the registrars have to agree and use the extensions in the same way in order for us to make a change, or is it something that for registrar A we could use the extension one way and provide, a string of information, and registrar B, they can use it a different way and provide different information via that string?
No, Barbara. If you were to implement this, you would basically be using the same string and it would be available to all of the clients at the same time.
And they would have to have the same information.
Well, yeah, correct. And any that wanted to take advantage of it, that is, because the extensions are optional. From a protocol perspective, you can implement policy exceptions to that. Like, somewhere in the registrar agreement, you can say that, we are going to make this extension available to you, and you are obligated to use it for these reasons or whatever. But there is no way to, come up with different strings on a per client basis.
Okay, so I just wanted to make sure that everybody was understanding that it's not as though we could negotiate with different registrars on how to use them then. So thanks for confirming.
Sure, you're welcome.
So this is Mikey again. I guess my concern is I'd like to find a way to do this that was sort of minimally disruptive, and I'm wondering if these text strings are those in the extension category and thus could be ignored by registrars if they so choose, or would they be more in the base implementation of EPP and thus all registrars would have to redesign their systems in order to accommodate them?
Well, it's part of the core specification. But that doesn't mean that the registrar would necessarily have to do anything. If their implementation was coded smartly, they would simply take that text string and pass it right on through. Given the number and diversity of registrars, I don't think that we can expect that that's how it would work all the time, though.
Yeah,
frankly, the easiest thing to do would be for this information to potentially be published or translated by registrars. I take that back, because not all registrars work with a thick registry or a thin registry. I don't think there is any completely easy way to do it.
If you started thinking about some alternative approaches, though, are there some easier ways that come to mind and some harder ways that we should for sure try to avoid?
Well, the absolute easiest way, given all the relative options, I think, is if you're working with a thick registry, there is one authoritative source of WHOIS information, and if the registry were to make such strings available and publish it in WHOIS, that's one way that the information could be available to the general public, and a registrar could choose to do something with it.
they wanted to. It's a little bit more difficult in the FIN registry situation because you've got a distinction between information published at the registry and information published at the registrars. It'd be nice if that were consistent, but consistency means a little bit more work on the side of both parties.
Yeah, okay. Gives me a lot to puzzle on. Thanks, Scott.
Okay. Does anybody else have any other queries for Scott? And actually, more importantly, is Scott still there? Or have we lost him? Oh, he's still there, I think.
Yeah, I'm still here, but he's probably going to be boarding soon.
Okay, no problem. Does anybody have any further questions for Scott, or shall we let the poor man get his flight?
I'm for letting the poor man get his flight.
And I'm not saying that VeriSign pays him badly or anything. It was more to do with his being stuck in an airport state of being. Okay, then. Scott, thank you very much for your time and assistance. I'm sure you've helped a lot of people understand us.
So you're very welcome. And if there are any follow-up questions, please feel free to send them to Barbara, and I can work it through her.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Goodbye.
Right then, I'm now going to cede the floor to Mr. Bladel.
Hi, McKelly.
Hello.
Hello. Am I on mute?
No, you're okay.
Okay. So, good morning, everyone, and I just wanted to provide an update on the urgent return sub-team, which consists of myself, McKelly, Mikey O'Connor, and Paul Diaz. In an overview, nutshell, and I won't take up too much time on the agenda, we have, during the break, had one meeting as well as several email exchanges to refine a different document. The end result is that I think we have a solid framework, or at least a skeleton, of a policy recommendation for an urgent return mechanism for inadvertent or fraudulent transfers. We may have also, although we didn't set out to do so, we may have also addressed the question of what to do when a registrant and admin contact dispute a transfer that has recently occurred, and that was another one of our charter questions. So we have this outline, as I mentioned. We've vetted it internally with our various teams, and that encompasses a couple of large registrars, a small registrar, some U.S.
registrars. I take offense to that. You're picking on my size.
Larger and less large registrars, as well as European and U.S.-based registrars. So we think that we're trying to get as much input into this process as possible. What I would like to do now as a next step is I would like to ask the permission or consensus of this working group before we bring this to the table. We recognize that there may be some elements of it that are just not applicable outside of our small little circle. So what we'd like to do is get some further input or feedback on this from other registrars and from registries. So we're asking the group if it would be permissible to submit this to Barbara and some of our friends at other registries, as well as some of our friends at other registrars who are not participating on the group, and have them vet this internally and make sure that we haven't made a glaring oversight or omission with regard to how they handle disputes and hijacks. So if that's okay, that would be our next step with the goal of bringing back that feedback to next Tuesday's meeting. So I put that question to the group.
Okay, Mass approves of this silently.
I'll speak if you'd like. Yeah, no, I think it's a great idea. I thank you guys for doing the initial work on it, and yeah, I'm more than happy to review it.
Okay, does anybody, I see lots of people approving of the idea. Anil, Barbara and Chris have all agreed. Does anybody have a serious issue with us circulating this to some of the other registrars and some of the registries? So we're working on the basis that unless we hear a very loud, noisy complaint now, we're going to assume that you're all okay with that. I hear noise on the line. Is that somebody just moving the phone or about to make a meaningful statement? Okay, that was just noise on the line. Okay, then. So working on that basis, James, Mikey, and myself will then look to moving this document out to several people and seeing if we can get some feedback and discover whether A, we're on track, or B, we're completely off course, or C, somewhere in the middle. Okay? Any other matters, anything else to do with this that you want to address, James?
No, I think that about covers it. I just wanted to express my thanks to you guys and my optimism that I think we have something really good here, and that's what makes me a little suspicious that we may be missing something. So I'd like to get some sanity checks from other folks.
Okay, perfect. Right. Moving on. We were looking, now I'm wary of the time, so what we'll do is we're not going to try to do too much today because I know that at least 50% of the people on this call, oh God, my browser just crashed. At least 50% of the people on this call are also on the vertical integration call, which is, I think, is scheduled for about three quarters of an hour's time. Would that be correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So what we'll if we can try to do is have a look at some more of the feedback. Sorry, I don't have. I'm waiting for my browser to restart, so I actually don't know what I'm looking at. Just looking at some more of the feedback, and I think something has gone up on the Adobe Connect. But as I don't have a functioning browser at the moment, I can't see that. Rika, could you take over from me for 30 seconds whilst my computer catches up?
Yes, no problem. This is Marika. I think we're actually almost through the stakeholder group and inconsistency statement, if I recall well. We're on the last comment for issue E, which was submitted by the IPC, which reads, it may be reasonable to clarify denial reason number 7 so that it expressly states that such a denial may include actions to address red flags that registrars become aware of relating to denial reason 1 concerning evidence of fraud. I don't know if any of the IPC representatives would like to provide some further details on that. Or
Berge, which number is that?
It's the last comment. It's on page 5. And it's actually page 6, almost at the top. The last comment in category E.
Okay. This is Anil. The basis for that comment was in the denial reason, it might be helpful to clarify for people who are involved with the receiving end of the denial that fraud is just the basis for doing that. If it wasn't obvious as it's written now.
Sorry, Neil, just to clarify, so you're saying is that if fraud was the reason for the denial of the transfer, you want to know that. Is that what you're saying?
Right, and to inform people that that fraud expressly is a reason why a transfer might be denied. my impression was that it may not be evident from the language now.
Okay. Does anybody have any comments on that?
This is Marika. I have a question, though, because I understood that denial region 7 means that a transfer is denied because the domain name is locked. So are you looking for a clarification that the registrar say the domain name is locked because of fraud reasons? Is
correct.
That the clarification you're looking for? Okay.
Correct.
Okay. Do any of the other registrars have any thoughts on this? Okay, James, and then Paul, please.
I'm not sure my comment is going to be all that valuable, so I'm willing to defer to Paul.
No, go on. Go on.
Okay, so my question is, we're talking about a reason for denial, but then the messy term lock was used. I think those are two separate things, because what we're talking about a reason for denial, typically aren't we speaking of a NAC or a rejection of a transfer request?
It may be. My question is, wouldn't it be locked because of a denial?
Sorry, Anil. You're saying that it wouldn't be in a lock because of the denial?
Well, I guess my question is, what would happen if there is what's the relationship between the lock status? Isn't there a relationship between that and denying the transfer?
Oh, it would fail. I don't think it would be denied. It's not a knack. It's a fail, isn't it? Or somebody can somebody clarify that?
No, I think that's right, Michele. I don't think you deny it if it's locked. I just think it fails.
Well, hang on a second, guys. Are we talking about if it's locked at the registry, right?
Yes. Sorry.
Yeah, we're talking about a lock that a normal human being can see.
Okay. Then yes,
as opposed,
right.
as opposed to a lock that you have to have magical powers to see.
Double secret lock.
Yes, exactly. You said it, not me.
I approve of it, though.
So basically we're saying that if the domain is locked at the registry level by the registrar or whatever, that it wouldn't be a knack, it would just be a deny or fail. Sorry, be a fail, not a deny.
Yeah, I don't even think the transfer request doesn't even get to the registry at that point.
Right. That's correct. Okay.
That's helpful to know.
Sorry?
All right, so that's helpful to know. So maybe it's not applicable in that sense.
Well, maybe it is. Paul, I'll let you come out with something.
Okay, well, sort of a question for the group and Anil in particular. If we were to add this clarifying language, I'm just not really clear who it benefits or how it helps. In other words, if we become aware and there are private lists that registrars are part of that share information about known domain hijackers and IP addresses they use. So if there's some of these characters that are very notorious that are out there and they're attempting to social engineer their way into various registrar systems and steal names, we will often, based on that information, lock some names that are potentially vulnerable. All right. If we get a customer, just dumb coincidence, that wants to do a transfer at that moment, the legitimate registrant, their transfer is going to fail because the name has been locked. They will only see that the name appears in EPP under a lock status, right? Client transfer prohibited. But they're invariably going to have to call and ask us, hey, what's going on? I want to move my name. And once they talk to customer service, establish a bona fides and whatnot, the name's unlocked, everything goes off the way they want. I'm just not really clear what is gained by trying to add some additional text here when we're dealing with the fraud cases.
My intent was to clarify that the registries have authority if they determine, as you're saying in the practice that you've outlined, that there is some type of fraudulent activity going on, that you have the authority to lock as a result of seeing that.
Just to follow up, would you believe, Anil, that that would be more appropriately addressed as part of a particular registrar's service agreement with their registrant, as opposed to amending ICANN policy?
Are you saying that it should be the service agreement should be?
Well, let me explain where I'm going with this. My concern is that if we do something at the ICANN level, it applies to everybody, and that could lead to the unintended consequence of the bad guys getting tripped off or tipped off that registrars are aware that they're up to something and are therefore locking them out of certain accounts. If registrars are required to do something because of consensus policy, that could be an unintended effect. If, on the other hand, what you're describing, which is more of I think it's ultimately a education purpose, right? Helping the registrant understand why their name was locked because of potential fraud. Maybe it's better dealt with at a service level agreement between that registrant and their registrar, and therefore, when it's dealt at that level, it doesn't raise the same prospect of the bad guys sort of figuring out how the systems are architected to try and protect against hijackings.
My intent is less educational for the registrant, but to make sure that it's clear to all parties that fraud can be a basis for locking. If there is some clear concern that an unintended consequence is that you would trip off a potential bad actor, then perhaps the service agreement may be the appropriate route if it's uniformly applied. My question would be, would it be uniform where all registrars would include that language?
Maybe you want to let others jump in, Michele. I have to think about that a bit.
Okay. Mikey?
Oh, for heaven's sake, the fire alarm just went off. Well, I'll make this brief. I really think that the focus of this particular issue E, isn't on the lock status, but on the reasonable means for the registered name holder to remove the lock status. And I think we're confusing the major focus of this particular issue. I'm not disagreeing or agreeing with Anil's thought. I just don't think that it's relevant to this particular issue.
I put myself on the queue. This is Michele. Anil, I'm just trying to understand. I'm still trying to get my head around what you're trying to do. Now, just bear with me just while I thrash this out. Are you trying to see that the concept of fraud as a reason for denying a transfer, that be made clear? Is that all you're trying to do?
Yes, made clear for the purpose of informing primarily the registrars that they have that authority to do that.
But, okay, now I'm not trying to be awkward or anything, but isn't that already pretty clear in the current IRTP policy?
That's my question, because my impression, and you correct me if I'm mistaken about this, was just reading, for instance, the report that was prepared on hijacking, it seemed like there were a lot of registrars whose hands were tied for whatever reason when there was clear evidence of fraud, and you get the impression that they're saying, well, there is something fraudulent, but the rules don't allow us to do anything about it, and therefore the registrant has to go through these hoops to provide evidence showing that this person who's clearly acting fraudulently is doing that.
Okay. I'm going to call on David to try to kind of answer some of this. I mean, David, are you aware of any issues in this area with regards to using fraud as a reason to deny a transfer?
This is Dave. No, actually, I'm not. I'm not currently aware of any.
Okay.
I'm sure that you know that those issues arise, but I don't have any specific data to share with the group.
Fair enough. I'm just speaking my own personal capacity. I can't speak for any of the other registrars. I mean, my understanding of it is that fraud, UDRP, court orders, et cetera, there's a list of specific reasons why, as a registrar, I can basically tell a registrant to get lost with regard to any request for a transfer. There's a whole load of things where I'd love to be able to reject the transfer, but I can't. If the domain's of my own accreditation, I can't do it because that would be in breach of the policy. Does anybody else have anything to add? Do any of the other registrars think it's not clear that you can reject a transfer based on potential fraud? Silence is killing me.
Michele, it's Paul. No, I mean, just it is clear, and we cite it whenever appropriate.
Okay. I mean, Anil, I think it might be if you have some specific examples of where registrars are saying that their hands are tied. I mean, specific cases, then maybe it's worth our while looking at those specifically. I'm not trying to be awkward here. I'm just trying to...
No, I understand. And you know, part of this may be that, you know, I'm not in your shoes, of most of you, in terms of registrar, registries, in terms of those rules. But if your point collectively is that there is no loophole that would prevent a registrar from... using fraud as a basis for denying a transfer, then I accept that. It wasn't clear to me that was so.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Now, just from my perspective personally, I mean, I've spoken to our credit card, our merchant acquiring bank and all that about this as well. I mean, basically, if we suspect or are made aware of a transaction of any kind where the credit card or whatever or the PayPal account has been used fraudulently, then as far as I'm concerned, everything to do with that is fair game. I mean, they've absolutely zero rights. They lose all rights immediately at every single level. I mean, we've had to do kind of all sorts of weird things, like changing the registration details to a kind of a weird holding account, because otherwise it was causing so many headaches. So, yeah. Okay, perfect. Right, look, guys, it's five to four. Much as I love these wonderful debates and discussions, I think we should call it a day because I know that a lot of people are going on to this next call. It's at 8:30, is that right? Can somebody confirm that in half an hour time?
Yes, that's right.
So I think to maintain your own mental sanity, I think we should call this a day. And because I think the next call could be what's the word I'm looking for? Lively?
A cluster.
A circus?
Circus, lively. I think the one I would like to have used was what was interesting. Could have been very large inverted commas. Colorful, challenging. There were plenty of other ones. If anybody has any other points they want to raise or if there's any questions or queries related to all the EPP stuff, which I think is a fascinating area, then, you know, there is the mailing list that people can use. And if anybody has anything else, anything else to say now?
This is Mikey, just a real quick thing. We might want to mine the transcript of that call for those descriptions of the statuses that Scott rattled off. I thought they were awfully good.
Okay, perfect. Who handles the transcripts? Never mind.
Excuse me, who gets the transcripts? But I'm happy when it comes out to pick out those pieces and put them in an email.
That would be absolutely fantastic, Marika, and that would be very much appreciated. Okay, so look, I'll talk to you all again and have a pleasant afternoon.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks, Michaela.
Thanks, Michaela.
Thanks, Michaela.
Okay, bye-bye.